Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hi, everybody. It's Nikki Nellis. Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. But actually, it's just Industry Night with me, Nikki Nellis, which I think is really going to start being the new thing. I keep threatening to do that, right, Alexia? But David is not here again today. So lucky me, I get the microphone all to myself as the host. But today I have an amazing guest, and I am so fortunate because she is a ridiculously good friend of mine as well. Tiffany McIsaac, you know her from Buttercream Bake Shop. She is literally the pastry chef to the stars here in DC. Everybody knows who she is. Everybody buys her cakes. Everybody loves her bake shop. Everybody follows her on Instagram. She does some of the most creative and beautiful sweet treats in this area. And I feel always grateful and fortunate to call her a dear friend of mine. One of the things I love doing on this show, Industry Night, that I don't get to do on the other show that I do called Foodie and the Beast, is I get to do deeper dives in the food industry, some with people I don't know, but even better is when it's with people I do. So hi, Tiff. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's like we're just talking on the phone, but we're in person. I know. But we still have these weird headphones on, so it's still kind of weird.
With mics in our mouths, right? I mean, it kind of looks a little phallic if somebody were to take this the wrong way.
It's a little weird.
It's a little weird. But we can power through. I think we can do it. So I'd love to talk a little bit about your background and your history. You started in Hawaii.
I did. I was born and raised.
Far away.
But I was never an island girl at heart. I always wanted to move away. My mom said from the time when I was a little kid, I said I wanted to move to New York. And I did that when I turned 18. I just didn't really know what I wanted to do.
Had you been to New York?
I'd been to New York once in the eighth grade as part of like a class trip to the East Coast.
Okay.
And I loved it. And it was like the best decision I ever made for my life. I'm so glad I did it.
Okay, so you wind up in New York City.
In New York City.
I picture you like with a suitcase and $2 in your pocket.
That was kind of what it was like because I was a dumb kid. So I was like, I'll just move to New York and stay in a hotel for a week and find a place to live. Somehow it worked out. But, you know, if I knew that now,
right,
like how it
course.
Is in New York,
you'd be like,
I would never
absolutely
do it.
Not.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely, for sure. But, you know, I thought I maybe wanted to do theater. I kind of tried that out for a little while. Didn't
love
it.
Well, because you were a dancer, right?
Mm-hmm. I was when I was younger. But as I, you know, was kind of trying to make it as an actress or a dancer and working in restaurants, I didn't grow up in a food family, but fell in love with restaurants.
In Hawaii or in New York?
No, in New York.
Okay.
In New York. It's actually funny because when I told my parents I wanted to go to culinary school, they were like, what? There's no money in food. There's no career in that.
Right.
We just didn't grow up going out to eat or, you know, looking at it as a feasible career.
Sure.
So,
well, to be fair, you grew up on Maui, right?
I grew up on Maui.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's expensive.
It's super expensive, and we also lived out in the country, so
okay. Yeah, but it's also super expensive.
It is.
In Maui.
I mean, everything's expensive there.
That's true.
And it's not like, I mean, now there's a lot of really wonderful restaurants and bakeries and things that have opened. But you know, when I was a kid in the 80s, there wasn't that much available. So I don't think there would have been too much to inspire me to begin with.
Got it. Okay, so you get to New York, and are you waitressing? What are you doing? How do you wind up in a restaurant?
Yeah, I was a hostess, you know, the most attached person in the building. I had no idea what was going on. I just kind of showed up and sat people and went home. And one day the chef said, you know, I feel like you should come into the restaurant and eat dinner. You talk about it all the time, but you've never actually eaten
here. And what was the restaurant?
It was called Michael's. It was on 55th between 5th and 6th. Okay. I'll never forget that because I said it on the phone a million times a day. And it was like a power lunch kind of place. I remember Katie Couric used to come in, and I thought she was so cool and beautiful and nice. But so I came in for dinner one night, and they just cooked for me. And I remember this dish they brought out. It was braised beef cheeks. And they put it down and told me that. And I was like, cheeks, like, on their face?
Right, you're like, my cheeks. Cheeks.
And they're like, yeah. And I was like, ugh, what?
Well, it could have been ass cheeks. I mean, I'm just saying.
It was amazing. And I was literally within a week like, can I come and check out the kitchen and see what you guys do in there? And so then I kind of started working in the kitchen for free one or two days a week to just sort of see what was up with it. And then I was like, yes, I love this. I need to go to culinary school.
So where'd you go to culinary school?
I went to the Institute of Culinary Education. Mm-hmm. It's in Manhattan. It used to be on 23rd, but I think that they moved down to where the World Trade Center used to be, the Twin Towers. And yeah, I went to culinary school for savory studies. And then
that's
I
what I was
going to
say. What was it about that?
I mean, number one reason was I really loved how precise the pastry was. I loved how pretty it was. I just really, it really spoke to me. But also, I really hate chopping onions.
Okay, that's fair.
And I was like, no, I don't want to do this.
Well, I wanted to ask you, so when you were doing both savory, before you went into pastry, did you feel like there was more room in the pastry program for women, that it was more accepting? Was there any of that at that time for you, or
you know what?
Not yet?
If there was, I wasn't aware. I think I was so young that I was just kind of excited to be a part of anything.
Sure.
And my class was very mixed. It was men and women, probably half and half.
Okay.
It wasn't until I started in kitchens that I realized how heavily weighted it was in the, you know, with male employees. So I didn't really notice that at the time. It wasn't something I was thinking about actively. I just really loved pastry. And so when I got out of school for my internship, I got a pastry internship instead of a savory one.
Okay. And so we keep using the term pastry, but I feel like we need to expand on that because there are desserts that you get in a restaurant, mm-hmm. right? And to me, that is pastry. And then there are cakes and brownies. Do you know what I mean?
Like, there's a lot of facets to it. Really, there's so much you can do. I mean, like, people really, it's interesting. It's like you wouldn't go to a savory chef that is at an American restaurant and be able to expect him to cook authentic Chinese food.
Right.
But you would go to a pastry chef and most people are like, oh, you can't make bread or you can't make ice cream. And it's like, well, there's a lot of different things that you can learn to do. And some people kind of do in more overarching studies. Like in restaurants, I think you get a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But in bakeries, it's a little more specific. So, you know, not everybody learns everything. Not every pastry chef has made bread or has a lot of experience doing it or has had an ice cream machine.
Well, when you were cooking, where did your passion lie initially? Were you like, I want to be in a restaurant?
I really loved restaurants. I mean, I didn't even give bakeries a thought. Maybe it's because I'd started, kind of fell in love with it in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually wasn't until I moved to D.C. that I even considered a bakery. And even then, I was worried about taking that on as part of what I did because I didn't think I'd like it. And now, you know, I own a bakery, so obviously I loved it.
Well, let's just talk a little bit more about your trajectory. You do an internship. When do you land your first big role as a pastry chef?
Well, it actually went for me a little faster than I probably would have liked it to. That just kind of is the way it worked out. I worked for a couple of years under other people, and then I applied for a sous chef position and did a tasting, and they were like, we really love that. We'd actually like to offer you the pastry chef position.
Okay.
Which was great. I took it. Everything worked out. Ultimately, if I could redo it again, I probably would have spent a few more years traveling and learning before you're
Did really... you have any mentors?
You know, I did, obviously. The first pastry chefs I worked for, I learned so much from them. The first pastry chef I worked for at Union Square Cafe, she was amazing. And I just knew nothing. So every single thing she showed me was like magical and amazing. And the first time I was seeing it. And I still remember the things she told me. So I think that every chef that you work for, you know, under as a pastry assistant or an executive chef that you work for side by side in a restaurant, you learn something from them.
Sure.
I think that the way to get stagnant is not to keep learning and not to keep looking at what other people are doing around you. That's one of the best things about the job, honestly.
Well, when you're working as a pastry assistant, you're executing somebody else's vision. How does that happen? How are you able to do that and do that successfully?
Well, luckily for me, when you're first starting out, you just know so little that you're barely keeping up. So it's like somebody shows you how to do something. And while you might have your own ideas, you just want to get it right. So you're just doing exactly what you're shown.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at home, you know, especially when I was a young cook, I baked all the time at home, nonstop. I just always had ideas. On my days off, I would even work in other restaurants for free to kind of see what people were doing. And I was just kind of trying to,
so would that
to,
be
like,
stodging? I mean, when you're doing that, is that, and it, you know, I don't think people really understand sort of the apprenticeship of stodging.
It's, it's a thing that I wish that we could do still.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for free because I just really wanted to see and learn what people were doing. Mm-hmm. I kind of looked at it like, well, if I work 5 days a week and I work 40 or 50 hours at this restaurant, you know, I'm going to learn a lot. But if I add two more days and I work 20 more hours a week, then
I'm going to learn
that much more, and I'm going to get where I want to get faster.
And what was that? I mean, hindsight, obviously, not necessarily what your young mind was thinking at the time, but what were the things you were looking to check off to learn? Was it execution? Was it recipe development? What was it?
There wasn't even a list. It was just everybody does things differently. Mm-hmm. There's so much to learn from just spending a day in a kitchen, just from the way that they organize their kitchen to the way that they present their lists to their staff. Like every single thing that a chef does is so personal to the way that they run their department. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much by going to see what other people did.
And so who would you say was the biggest influence when you came down to DC on how you initially organized your kitchen?
In like when I got here?
Yes.
Well, by that point, I'd already been a chef on my own for a while. And at that point, I actually moved with my husband.
Right.
And we ran the kitchen together. So.
That's Kyle Bailey. He's the executive chef at Saltline, among other restaurants as well.
So, you know, he and I really collaborated on how we had always wanted to do things.
Right.
You know, we weren't owners of this restaurant, but we were getting to start it from zero. And we hadn't done that before. Mm-hmm. So we just took all the things that had driven us crazy over the years and tried to make sure we didn't make those mistakes again. But there isn't, you know, the best formulated plan when you're opening a restaurant just kind of all goes to hell when it opens.
Right.
You have to be able to
roll
with the punches.
Right.
It is. It's like you can do all the planning in the world, but at the end of the day, once that thing opens, it takes on its own life. Mm-hmm. And you have to just kind of roll with the punches. So while we planned a lot and thought we had this amazing plan for the staffing and the structure of the kitchen and the layout, you know, 6 months after we opened, we kind of threw it all away and said, okay, we have to start over because this isn't perfect.
So for people who don't know your history, you and Kyle came down here to open up Church Key and Birch and Barley, mm-hmm. which in DC, so what, how long ago is that? Is that 10 years?
It was 9 years ago.
9 years ago, yeah, that's what I thought.
Not that I want to date myself.
No, me either, but I mean, that's when I met you, and yeah. I just remember it so well. But it was, first of all, it was one of the first restaurants on 14th Street with mm-hmm. any sort of real permanent standing.
Definitely on that end of the street.
Oh, on that
sure.
end of the street without, yeah. I mean, it's sort of, you know, 14th Street was just beginning to gurgle with new buildings and new restaurants, but you were really the yes. first. But it was also the first time a concept that, for those of you who don't know, Birch and Barley and Church Key is this massive beer concept with over 500 beer offerings. And I mean, well-sourced beer yes. offerings with Greg Engert, who has been in studio before. But you guys created a menu to
be paired with the beers.
To be paired with beers. And that was also, it was an upscale dining option. And then Church Key was the
more casual
bar. But you had mm-hmm. bar bites and you did the bread program. I mean, it was a massive.
It was
a massive undertaking.
It was pretty great, honestly. We really got to do all the things we wanted to do. I mean, like, I called the bread program like my best worst idea because I was like, oh yeah, maybe we'll do like, you know, have like a rotation of breads, but people started loving them so much.
Oh my
like
god, for the record, the problem with your bread program, there was one problem with the bread program, is that everybody would eat all of it and then they would be full. I mean, it was so with the pretzels and the biscuits. No, I know. I did it to myself every single time. It was fabulous.
It was a pretty special place. I'm not going to lie.
Like,
we really loved it.
But nobody was doing anything like that at the time. Like bread programs had completely fallen by the wayside at this point. So you really like put your A game into it and launched a whole new way to start off the meal.
Yeah, we did. We loved it.
And then let's talk about the desserts that you developed there. That's when, like, you were doing the ho-hos, right? Like, I'm mm-hmm. thinking of some of the dishes, but how did you and Kyle...
And confections plates that had the little ho-hos and the Snicker bars and, you know, those kind of playful things. But, oh, man, that was the great thing about that restaurant is I just really got to do whatever I can. I mean, I have to say, as a pastry chef, working for your husband is pretty great because he doesn't tell you what to do. You just get to do anything. And that's not always the scenario as a pastry chef.
But were there things that you both collaborated on? Were there beers that you thought, like, were there things, like, how did you work with that program?
Because
in my head, I don't think beer and desserts.
No, and that's what's funny. Beer and desserts actually go together amazingly. I mean, like, obviously not every beer, but for me in particular, I love sour beers, and sour beers pair beautifully with a lot of desserts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we also had some hard ciders that were really pretty special that went well with it. Mm-hmm. Some of the bigger, you know, heavier beers went really deliciously with things. So we got to drink a lot of beer, which was great. Shift meals, our shift beer, which is the drink you have after work, was, you know, equal parts for enjoyment, but also for educating ourselves about what we had on the menu and on draft so that we could pair them properly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just got to do so many creative things. And the people that came there, it was really interesting because for being beer driven, you don't always think of beer drinkers as people that want to eat really unique foods and unique combinations.
Right.
But Birch and Barley kind of changed that.
Absolutely.
And I really, really love that about it. And my husband's super passionate about beer. So for him, it was like a dream project.
Well, and it, I mean, even though neither of you are there today, you created a whole new way for people to view beer and pair with food. I just don't think people were thinking that way at the time. There was a lot of people sort of playing with the concept. And I'm not just talking about locally in D.C. I mean, nationally.
Totally.
I mean, you guys were out before Publican in Chicago.
I think a lot of people were still thinking the way to incorporate beer into food was to cook with it.
Right.
But I remember Greg said something really smart. He was like, why would you cook with it? It's already done. When they make it, they give it to you, and that's how it's supposed to be enjoyed. You know, somebody wouldn't get a burger from you and then be like, I'm going to do more to this.
Right. That's a good finished. Point. That is a very good
so
point.
So we really didn't cook with beer. The only thing that beer really went into was we made sauerkraut and we made pretzels, and those got beers in them. But
okay.
Other than that, we didn't really cook with beer. It was more about
and the mustard.
Pairing the flavors and
there
the mustard.
Mustard mm-hmm. and the beer and the mustard. Right?
Yeah, there was just like a very few things. It wasn't mm-hmm. like things weren't being braised in them and, you know. We weren't using it all over the place.
Right. And then, so that restaurant group, mm-hmm. neighborhood restaurant group, had multiple properties and was expanding. So your role changed. And you went from not just creating and being in the kitchen with your husband, but for coming up with other people's concepts and then a bakery. So can we talk a little bit about that? Because that role seems ginormous.
It was. You know, when I first started with the company, they had, I think it was like 6 restaurants and 1 bakery.
Okay.
And so when I started, I was doing the pastry program at Birch and Barley. I was there all the time. It was really our baby. We loved it. And then they said, you know, we'd love for you to take a bigger role and kind of have you run the bakery and also run all of the pastry department programs. So you'll mm-hmm. help the chefs set up a program, develop the recipes, give them the recipes, show them how to execute them. But then they'll have a staff on site that will take care
that
of the day-to-day.
That will actually do it. Right.
Mm-hmm. And I was actually really excited about it. It seemed like a really big challenge, and I was excited to get to do a lot of different types of food because there were so many styles of restaurants, but I was really scared of the bakery. I had no idea what it was going to be like. You know, at a restaurant, you might make 20 of a dessert for a night, but at a bakery, you might make 400 cupcakes.
Right.
And I just
want to say for the record that 10 years ago or 8 years ago, whenever you took on that role, that was sort of the height of cupcake mania,
God.
Right? I mean, people forget.
I had literally never baked a cupcake.
Really?
Like, I'm just not a cupcake person. I've never gone to a cupcake shop. Like,
I mean,
and then
we can all poo-poo it now, but you know, people went insane.
We still make them at my bakery. I'll never not have them because people truly do love them.
They
the
love
people
them.
That love them, they come into a bakery, they don't see a cupcake, they're turning around and leaving. That's
Isn't that
the thing they want. It is amazing.
It's really amazing.
But
listen, when I drive by, what's that place in Georgetown?
Oh,
Georgetown Cupcake.
Georgetown Cupcakes. There's
and there's
always
a line. I'm like, there's another cupcake place down the street, people.
Oh, Baked and Wired?
Yes.
So good.
And it's so good.
It's so good.
Okay, so you take on the bakery. You mm-hmm. take on all the other chefs. Once you get into the bakery, what was it? What did you find there that was working for you?
I mean, it was really interesting. It was the first time I'd ever had an overnight staff.
Which people don't even think about, so you need to explain it.
Oh, man. I mean, at that point, it was small because we were producing the desserts for the bakery and then the desserts for a couple of other restaurants. And then at Birch and Barley, they were doing the desserts for the rest of the restaurants.
Okay, so was it composed desserts for the restaurants?
It was components of composed desserts.
Okay.
And then they would assemble them. It was
right.
pretty complicated, actually.
It sounds complicated. So, like, would you provide, like, the pastry shell and the pastry cream mm-hmm. and the fruit or whatever, like, give directions, and then they would have to put all the components together?
So we would give them, basically, they would get, like, an ice cream from us. They'd get, like, the main components. Anything mm-hmm. that was fresh, fruit and stuff, they would just order themselves, and I'd show them how to prepare it.
Right.
But, yeah, they would get, like, you know, there was all of these order guides for every restaurant and this whole giant list. I mean, at one point, as the company grew, we would have, like, 30 or 35 different kinds of ice cream at a time rotating through the commissary kitchen that they eventually had to build.
Wow.
So it was, I mean, it went from being, thank God it was in baby steps.
Sure.
I mean, it went from 6 properties to like 18 by the time I left the company because some of the properties had dual concepts with 2 menus. I mean, it was like
massive.
It was crazy. Plus we were doing wholesale. And we were doing bread for some of the restaurants for one of the sandwich shop concepts. So mm-hmm. it was pretty
daunting.
Pretty daunting. There was a donut shop. I mean, right. like.
wait, so can we back up a little bit? Because yeah. when you said earlier in the show, you said when people go to pastry school, you know, they don't necessarily get trained in everything. And now you're talking about doing bread and ice cream and pastries and cakes. So were you trained in everything or did you? How,
I definitely was not.
How did that happen? I mean, how did that happen?
I mean, like I said, you know, I learned a lot in kitchens. In culinary school, it's really interesting. So, you know, if you go to a 9-month program or 2-year program or whatever program you go to, there's so much to learn. You do everything just for a minute. You know, mm-hmm. it's like even if you go to just pastry, you might learn bread, but you might spend 3 days doing bread. Mm-hmm. That's not even the tip of the iceberg, you know? Right. So while you've come out of school and you've touched your hands on everything,
you haven't really learned a thing.
You know, right. it's like you really know nothing. You just have enough to get your foot in the door. So, you know, you try to find chefs that you can work for that specialize in something that you really want to learn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went to work for a chef who did a lot of chocolate, and I went to work for a chef who did a lot of bread, and I went to a restaurant that had a bigger bread program before I was there.
Okay.
So I kind of got to learn it when I took over the pastry department. So
sure.
I think you just kind of self-teach yourself a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. chefs are really magicians when it comes to, like, you think of something and then you just have to figure out a way to do it.
Right.
There is a way. You have to figure it out. The best way, the efficient way, and the way that tastes good every time.
But, you know, savory versus pastry. Savory
so
gives...
different.
Well, it's so different. But when you're cooking, whether you're a trained chef or you're cooking in your house, you know, you can throw a little salt in, you can throw a little pepper in, maybe you feel like throwing in a little oregano. Like, you can play with dishes. When you're doing pastry, cakes more specifically, but ice cream,
anything
that needs to be stabilized, it's science.
Yes.
So there is a math to how things work. That part is always a struggle for me, because even though I love baking, I suck at math.
Well, it's hard too, because math. It's like, if you're just starting out, you need a recipe. You can't just go in the kitchen and be like, I'm going to make vanilla ice cream today, because
right.
you might have no idea how to do that. Whereas if you say, I'm going to roast a chicken, that's pretty self-explanatory. The name says what you do,
right,
you know?
Exactly.
So I think that...
It's like pound cake, pound, 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 which yeah. isn't really
isn't
accurate.
It really great, though?
Right. It's not really accurate.
It definitely makes a thing in a shape of a cake, and it works, but it's not the most delicious
pound
cake.
It's not really very good, right?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody figured out a better way after the pound, pound, pound thing. Mm-hmm. But, so I think that, like, you just kind of learn as you go, mm-hmm. and I think when I took on that bigger role, I realized I was afraid a little bit, because I was like, this is a lot to take on, but I was also like, this is an amazing opportunity to get to learn and test and develop a whole bunch of recipes that if I were running one property, I would not get to do.
Right.
So it was a huge learning curve, but it was an amazing opportunity.
Well, and plus that company grew incredibly, and you were dabbling. Like you said, you mm-hmm. guys had the donut shop and the fried chicken, donuts and fried chicken for a while when that was a big trend. I mean, you just mm-hmm. sort of rode these waves with these massive trends that you guys were able to, you know, sort of
grab onto
yeah. and execute, which is really fascinating. And I guess my question is that when all of it was winding down, when you were like, okay, I need a break from this, it's a lot. Where did the bakery fit in? At what point were you like, I really like doing this? Like, my dream now has changed. I've worked in all these restaurants. I've been a director of pastry for a huge restaurant group. I've executed composed dishes. I've done bakery, cupcakes, donuts, ice cream. At what point were you like, I would like to step back?
Well, I think it was partly step back. I mean, part of me was saying, if I'm running all of these programs and I have 18 people working for me in the kitchen and I've got 6 people working overnight to get all the things ready for the morning and, you know, another however many people working during the day, and I'm dealing with all these chefs and all their concepts, I feel like I could just do one way easier. I mean, it'll still be hard because it will be my own, mm-hmm. but it just made logical sense, because honestly, I was going nuts and I wasn't even getting to be in the kitchen anymore. I was just running and scurrying around, putting out fires and figuring out what to do. So I just decided I wanted to do something smaller. It didn't have to be a bakery, but I also wanted to be my own boss at that point. And it's really hard as a pastry chef. You kind of have to open your own concept, because you're never going to be in charge at a restaurant.
Right.
Unless you're the executive chef of the, you know, unless you also cook savory. which some pastry chefs go on to do, and I think that's amazing. But for me, I knew I wanted to focus on pastry, I wanted to be my own boss, and I wanted to have a single property concept.
Well, and I think you also, given that you worked in the DC market for a long time at this point, and for a very large restaurant group, I think you really had your finger on the pulse of what was missing in the DC market.
Totally.
Because you could have opened a pastry, you know, like there's no dessert bars in DC, right? And there was a moment where, like, when you went to Philly or New York mm-hmm. or San Fran in LA, there were like dessert bars, right?
Totally.
That you could, and I don't mean like a cupcakery kind of place. I mean, like, after
sit
dinner,
down and get composed desserts, right, and composed, cocktails.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And that, I don't know what, it just wasn't taking off here. Nobody was executing it. And
it's really cool concept, but it's really hard to keep it alive, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah. Food businesses are so crazy. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like so many of them closed before 5 years. And I just wanted to do something that I knew was going to be something that people could be excited about, that could be accessible to everyone. So, you know, you can come in, somebody can come in and spend $2 and get a cookie mm-hmm. and come and visit us, or somebody can come in and spend $5,000 on a wedding cake. I mean,
right.
It's really, there's something literally for everyone. And I really love that about it. I love that, you know, when you're in a fancy restaurant, you're getting a certain kind of person coming in to dine. We're a bakery that everyone can come to. And that really was important to me.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to, as a small business run by a woman in the District of Columbia, I really want to go through some of the paces. And full disclosure, I was there with you for a lot of it. I mean, I don't work with her, but I know a little bit more probably than I should. But I think people need to know about what it's like to run a small business in the food world in DC as a woman, and what it took to find space, raise funds, and then execute your vision. So this is Nikki Nellis. I'm chatting with Tiffany McIsaac of Buttercream Bakery here in Washington, D.C. We are in the fabulous Line Hotel in our little glass enclosed space. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more.
Man, if you don't know what ghetto style means by now, I guess we just gonna have to break it down for you. Rock the beat.
It's Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast once again. It's just me, Nikki Nellis, tonight, and I am live here in the Line Hotel in our little glass enclosed area with full service radio. For those of you who don't know, I've been covering the DC food and wine scene for the last 15 years, launched a website called The List, Are You On It.com that lists every food and wine event going on in the DC metro area. And you can always check it out if you're looking for the latest in food and wine happenings. I also have another radio show which is celebrating 10 years this weekend. David and I, the Beast, have been on air for 10 years on 1500, and we're so excited to celebrate. We're doing a huge 2-hour live show party at Blue Jacket Brewery down in the Navy Yards. It is not a ticketed event. It is live and fun. There'll be lots of beers and lots of brunch items. So please make a reservation and please come and join us. It's from 11 to 1. But now I'd like to get back to my guest, Tiffany McIsaac, who has taken us through her trajectory of pastry chefdom here in the DC. And where we left off was she has now... She was working with Neighborhood Restaurant Group. She was running a massive, massive pastry program that included a commissary and ice cream and donuts and a baker, two bakeries and a pastry for a ton of properties, and had decided to pull back and do something on her own. Go.
And it was that easy, and then I just did
right.
it.
No. And then we opened up a bakery, and I became famous.
Bakery.
Right.
No, I mean, when I first decided to leave, I wasn't exactly sure if it was going to be a bakery or I'd go to a restaurant. I even at one point told my husband, you know, what if we turned our garage into a small kitchen and I just made wedding cakes out of the house? And he looked at me and he's like...
Because you had started making cakes.
Well...
It became sort of a side.
It did, well, we started,
under their umbrella.
We started doing cakes because we knew we were going to be opening the bakery. So we started doing wedding cakes out of my house, thinking it's going to take so long for business to pick up that I'll start trying to sell cakes now so that we've got, mm-hmm. you know, weddings booked when we open. And luckily, I was very wrong. It went very quickly.
Right.
Next thing you knew, I had a commercial refrigerator at my house, and we had five weddings in a weekend sometimes. And one of my friends with the bakery, thank God, Sarah, who used to own Grassroots Gourmet, she right. let me use her bakery for my business partner Alex and I, so that we could prep all of the cake batters there, and then we'd take all the cakes back to my house and decorate them and stack them and get them all ready to deliver, and then we'd run out and deliver them together. I mean, it was really crazy. But
so let me ask you a question. So you decide, okay, I'm going to open up a bakery, but why not just open a wedding cake business? I mean, that seems like a very specific business that you could have focused on
totally.
Entirely, right? I mean, it's very... People don't understand. When you said, like, $5,000, you know, that's not what they all go for.
No.
But when people hear that cakes can go that high, that they're that expensive, let's explain why. I understand why.
Totally.
Because people, like, it's sugar and flour and salt. Like, what costs so much money?
It totally is sugar and flour and salt, and that's, like, the base of what
eggs.
We're doing, and eggs and tons of butter. Lots and lots and lots,
lots
of butter.
Lots of butter.
Thanks, Cabot Creamery. You're the best. But, you know, most of our cakes range in, like, for weddings range between, like, 600 and 1,000, and that
okay.
could be for, like, up to 200 people. So they're fairly, you know, decent-sized wedding cakes. But sometimes we have a person who wants a cake covered in sugar flowers, and this could be hundreds of sugar flowers, and one sugar flower could take an hour and a half to 2 hours to make.
Wow.
So this is the kind of thing where we spend months and months preparing for this cake while we're working on other projects that are, you know, mm-hmm. currently going out the door, but we're also working on sugar flowers every week. So you're really paying for the labor that goes into the artistry of the design, so it's all design-based. And, you know, we'd like to say we really can make something for everyone, but certain people want something that's just out of this world. And we love getting those weddings, but we also love being a part of the simple weddings, because
sure.
almost everyone that gets married then comes to us for their anniversary cake, and then they come to us for their, you know, baby shower cake, and then for their first birthday. So we get to be in their life pretty much forever, and that's pretty awesome.
That is so sweet. I love that.
Yeah, we're 3 years in, and we've now had people who have had their kids' first and second birthdays with us, and, you know, we've become the place they come to every year. They bring their kids in. We know them. It's awesome.
That's sort of an unintended...
A great side effect of
exactly,
the job.
Exactly, yep. right? That's
it's
amazing.
Been, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to have, though, a full-service bakery.
Well, that's so that sort of takes me there.
Yep.
So you were doing these wedding cakes out of your house,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I mean, you were busy.
We were busy.
Very,
much
very busy.
Busier than I thought I'd be. I mean, very busy for being just Alex and I.
Right.
Alex part-time, me full-time, because she had another job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were also building the bakery at this point. So there was a lot of time and man hours going into being on site, being part of construction, looking for employees, doing
recipe
development.
But what was your vision? So let's talk about your vision for the bakery, because you have this whole wedding cake component, which, mm-hmm. you know, is like a full-time business.
Yes.
You already know that. And then you decide, and I want to also have a bakery. And let's be honest. I mean, D.C. is not known for bakeries. There's not a lot of bakeries in D.C. There's not even a lot of bakeries in the suburbs.
Right. I mean, now I feel like there's a few really great ones
there
that
are.
I love. Yep. Like,
but There wasn't.
No, there really weren't. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do a bakery. I thought, you know, this is something that like this neighborhood could use. Mm-hmm. It's near the convention center, so people that come to town can come and experience us. And I think it's a nice taste of DC. But then also there's a huge amount of residential people in Shaw that come down every single day and get breakfast with us. So,
right.
You know, it was a great location that just kind of happened upon me. It was the first location I saw. And I thought it was so perfect. There was no way it would work out. There's no way I could afford it. I had to go, you know, my kitchen is so large in the basement that I ended up having to kind of partner with some guys that are friends of mine. They own a pizzeria right next door and they rent part of my kitchen.
Well, so that's Mikey Friedman, all purpose.
They've been on before.
They
I'm
have
sure.
been on. Yep. Mikey was on a couple weeks ago.
So, you know, and that's just part of, that's one of the things I love about the DC food scene. There mm-hmm. are so many young chefs coming up. I mean, young, I'm 37, but, you know, younger.
You're young.
Younger
you're
than
young.
Others. Younger than some
okay,
others.
Okay, bitch, you're young. We know. Go ahead.
But all the chefs here, the majority of the chefs are such good friends. We all lean on each other. We all support each other, help each other. And I could have never gotten this bakery open if it hadn't been for the support of the guys that own Red Hen and All Purpose. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we found the space. We decided we were going to do it. We launched the name. We said, coming soon. We're going to start doing wedding cakes out of our house, out of my house. And then fast forward a year and a half, mm-hmm. we're in the space, and we've got lots of weddings booked. We actually do all of the weddings for the Line Hotel. Yep. We do all the wedding cakes for here.
Wow.
We do the wedding cakes for Mandarin Oriental and Hay Adams. So we work with a lot of hotels, but then we also have a lot of walk-in clients. That's a huge part of our business. Probably half of our business is
weddings. Well, so, but I want to talk about, as a first-time business owner, mm-hmm. you wanted to be your own business owner. I mean, you had the site selection help with Mikey and the team from All Purpose, but it's not like you had a check to stroke.
Oh my gosh.
So you had to raise funds. And as a woman, was that harder for you than it was for like the guys next door?
I don't know if it was harder per se because I'm a woman. I'll never know because I'll never know what it's like to do it and not be a woman, mm-hmm. I guess. And they're totally different concepts, so it's hard to compare them.
Sure.
Apples and oranges. But one thing I will say is that asking for money is one of the most uncomfortable and hard things I've ever had to do. And it was something that
I... Can I borrow $20?
Oh, my joking. God. I'm happy to give you some. Right, yeah, but yeah. asking someone to give it to me, knowing full well that like I've watched many friends open restaurants that were amazingly talented and have the restaurants close.
Right.
And so, you know, my biggest thing is whenever I talk to somebody about my sales pitch at the end, I'd always say, and, you know, if you really need this money, make sure you don't give it to me because I could lose it.
Right.
They'd be like, you should leave that part out of the pitch. And I'm like, well, but you know what? It's something that we really need to talk about. Now, I will tell you, I'll kill myself trying to make sure that doesn't happen. I'll work every hour of every day trying to make sure we make enough money to pay you back and make a business that you can be proud of. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what's going to happen. I can't see the future.
But how did you know how to put together a model? Like, did you, because you had opened up other restaurants, were you able to say, okay, so this is how I'm going to borrow the money, mm-hmm. and this is the structure I'm going to pay it back? Because I feel like, I mean, listen, I know you had your wedding cake business, and you knew that you were going to be making money there, but all of a sudden you had staff, and you had rent, and you had all these other things.
So much. Yeah.
So how were you able to put together
the business proposal?
Business proposal and how you were going to pay people back.
Well, I guess the number one thing that was that I was lucky was that I had worked at the bakeries before.
Sure.
So I had an idea of, you know, what the kind of flow of business would be with people walking in and how much the coffee costs would be and how much the food costs would be on the baked goods. And,
okay. You
know, I already had a lot of connections in the city as far as what to buy, where to buy my food products from, mm-hmm. my base ingredients. So I had a rough idea, and I did everything very conservatively. I mean, even when I would show people as I was kind of pitching this out to them, they'd say, these numbers seem really conservative. And I said, yes, that's on purpose because I want to know that even if we're doing what I would consider almost failing, I'm still going to be able to make enough to pay you guys back because okay. that's my number one, before we even get to me trying to make some money for myself,
right.
is to make sure that the people who have trusted in me and given me a lot of money, you know, you had
so
to, you
how
have
many,
to raise more than half $1 million.
Right. So how many investors did you have?
So we ended up having 12 investors in total.
Okay.
Each owning different portions.
Sure.
Amounts of the business. Mm-hmm. And every one of them, I'm so grateful to. They've all been amazing. They've given me complete autonomy. I mean, you know, part of it is that in the contract, I make all the decisions. But all of them could be coming to me saying, I've got an idea. We should try this. We should try that. And really none of them have.
That's so nice.
They've been the most amazing humans to work with on this and have been so supportive and so great. There was even a point in time where I thought I might do a second location, and more than one of them said to me, we would love that because you're doing so great and we just get to sit here and we'd be happy to invest. But how are you going to feel personally if you're giving up all of your time to open another spot? Is that something you really want to do?
Sure.
And I don't think that that's something that every investor would tell to the person that they're investing in. You know, think, put me first.
Right.
Before their own personal financial well-being, you know?
No, that's really interesting. And
so
how,
I'm really lucky.
How is the paying? So your business has been around for almost 2 years.
2.5 years.
2.5 years, mm-hmm. Right? So it's almost 3 years in April.
Yep.
So how long does it normally take to pay people back?
Well,
What did you think?
It was going to take 4 or 4.5 years. That was kind of our guess.
And?
And we just finished.
Oh, my God.
We just cut the last checks last week, actually. So that was a really, felt so, really, really good.
I bet. Congratulations.
Like, so now I have goosebumps just thinking about it. It felt so good.
Everybody's paid off.
Everybody's paid back. They still own their shares, their percentages.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So.
But.
As the bakery continues to grow, they'll still get
a
distribution dividends or
check.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about, so we know all about the wedding cake business, mm-hmm. but I really want to talk about the kind of offerings you have at the bakery because right. they're so creative.
Thanks.
You know, it's not like, I grew up with bakeries in New Jersey, and
there's some good bakeries in Jersey.
Listen, I'm not
it's
complaining.
Like super classic and so
but
delicious.
Right, like they're like Italian yeah. bakeries, like with the Italian cookies, mm-hmm. which I adore, and you know the simplest of cakes. That's not this bakery. You know, you have your bakery is very whimsical, and your products are very creative. They're not classic, and I don't mean that in a negative way.
No,
it's
no.
just like when people walk in, they're eyes go wide because it's not what they're expecting.
Yeah, we try to keep an even mix. So, for example, if somebody comes in every day, we'll have 2 or 3 cupcakes. Mm-hmm. We always have a couple of gluten-free options. We've always got classic chocolate chip cookies and, you know, a few things that people can come in. And if they're not adventurous, they can still definitely find something to eat.
Right.
But then as far as other stuff, we do really try to keep it fresh, use unique ingredients, you know, like we do lots of like kind of almost over the top, really indulgent things. Like people all the time will email and say, you know, I'm on a diet, but I really love your bakery. And I'm wondering okay. when I come in, what should I get that's the most healthy? And I just say, listen, I got to be honest. There's 2 kinds of food, good for your heart and good for your soul. We're the second one.
Right.
So if you're trying to be good to your heart, then, you know, maybe walk around the block 3 or 4 times before
make it
you
worth
come
it.
In. But, you know, we probably go through 400 pounds of butter a week.
Wow.
So we're using all
butter.
Of those things.
Right, butter,
food.
Sugar, flour.
Yep.
Well, some of the items that I think are really interesting and creative, like you, the macaroons that you do, the little French cookies mm-hmm. that you hand paint. Like you take a special time.
We do.
To do a lot of art on just your, and this is going to come out wrong because I don't mean it poorly, but like you take a lot of time on products that you could just sell without the extra time.
Totally.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like
yep.
like your chocolate covered Oreo gems.
Yep.
You know, which you are very well known for. I mean, they look like pieces of
little
jewelry.
Gemstones.
Right,
yeah.
little gemstones, but they're filled with Oreos.
I think that kind of comes from my time in restaurants mm-hmm. because you're always trying to find a new and fun way to present something to someone so that it's not just the same old thing they could cook at home all the time. It's
mm-hmm.
so like when somebody comes to the bakery, I mean, a chocolate-covered Oreo is a pretty standard thing, so we just try to make it a little bit prettier and a little more special so that you have a reason to come and see us and not somebody else or just to make it yourself.
Right. But you also do things like the unicorn poop.
Yes. That was such a weird idea, but that was like one of the funnest moments of my life was piping that and having it come out. I was like, oh my gosh.
So can you explain it?
So we basically took a pastry bag that you would pipe like buttercream or whatever mm-hmm. out of, and I painted stripes of rainbow colors inside of it and filled it with marshmallows and then piped it, so it had this really vibrant marshmallow swirl, and I was like, this is so fun. And I was like, oh my gosh, it looks like that poop emoji,
right? It
like,
does.
Oh, this is totally, we got to call this unicorn poop.
And now but like it's like a favorite.
It's like
everybody
a thing now.
Loves
yep.
it.
We don't make it in the shop, we actually just do it for special orders.
Sure.
But it's definitely something that we get a lot of orders for.
I bet, because it's so gorgeous.
It's just
and
so
beautiful.
Fun.
It
yeah.
is fun. But actually, I think that's what it is about the bakery, is that it is so much fun. But, you know, you have, I mean, my favorite in the bakery, I mean, I love your baked goods, you know that. But my favorite are your savory.
Oh, the breakfast bombs and stuff
like
that.
The breakfast bombs are, I mean, they're insane.
One of our busiest times of day is the morning. A lot of people stop in and get boxes of treats for breakfast for the office. So we do try to have, you know, a mix of savory, vegetarian, and non-vegetarian items for breakfast.
So do you do muffins too?
We have muffins. We usually have one or two muffins a day. We have scones. A savory and a sweet scone. Then we've got our flakies, which is like a croissant that's filled with the cream and rolled in sugar. And then we've got our version of a Queen Amon. But
which is like ridiculous,
sugar.
Right?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's
it is
and
a really
good one.
We actually
call that we actually Queen Amon. It has kind of a weird French spelling,
right?
So we actually spell it like Q U E E N and then the word B because we didn't want anybody to come in and not order it because they didn't know how to say it.
Honestly, I think that's a brilliant idea because it can be intimidating when you don't know how to pronounce something.
People always say "Oh, Queen Amon," and then it's like. Or Coogan Ammon, and our staff was like, oh, it's actually Queen Amon. And, you know, you don't want to embarrass people. You just wanted to get their breakfast.
Just get your breakfast.
On their day. Exactly.
Well, can we talk about the breakfast bombs? Because they are my favorite.
Your son likes them, too.
I know. We all like them. So what I do, for people who don't know, this is my secret trick.
Pro tip.
My pro tip is I go into Buttercream Bakery, and I'm going to explain the breakfast bombs. They are, well, wait, what's the dough?
Milk bread. It's like a tender white bread.
Okay, so it's if you put your fingers together to make, or make like a bigger than a fist. It's like a round circle when you put your hands together. It's a big ball of dough that is filled with eggs and bacon or sausage and cheese, and then baked up, and it is... so scrumptious and delicious. So what I do
and
is
it's
I,
easy to eat too on the go.
Yes, you know? It's easy to eat on the go. And what I do is I buy them, I wrap them in plastic wrap and throw them in the freezer. And then my children blast them in the microwave in the morning and voila, breakfast is served.
There you go. It's genius.
It is. It's a genius dish and it's really delicious.
And it's nice. Like people can come in and they can get something like that that's really hearty for under $5. So we try to be really... you know, we're not a cheap bakery by any stretch of the imagination, but we do try to have some things where people can come in and come and see us every day or a couple of times a week. Like a regular in a restaurant comes in twice a month, but a regular in a bakery comes in five times a week.
Right. Well, because
you know, so we have to make it accessible for that.
Well, because you have residential, so you have multiple
it's
guests.
The best neighborhood.
You have the residents who live there. Mm-hmm. You have the people who work there. And then you have the convention center goers.
Yep.
Like you're...
And then there's also a few hotels as well. The hotels are really great about sending us people. We'll have people that come with their family for 5 days and they come and get breakfast every day. And by the time they've left, they've tried everything. And
that's kind of cool.
It's awesome. Yeah, it's great.
So when you opened up in the Shaw area, what about staffing? And like from a back a little bit to the business perspective. I mean, when you talk about people working overnight for the bakery, because I assume if you're opening up at, what time do you open up? 7?
We open up at 7.
Mm-hmm. So if you're opening up at 7 in the morning, that means all your baked goods have to be ready at 7. So how do you do all that?
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to do when we opened this bakery was I really didn't want to have a person, unless I found someone that wanted to, that had to work strictly overnight.
Right.
So the first person gets there at 4:30 in the morning, which is painful but not undoable. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, you've done it.
I've definitely done it. Yep. I hate it, but I've done it.
I hate it for you.
I pray that I don't have to do it often.
Right.
But, you know, on occasion we have to run in and help out. But yeah, somebody comes at 4:30 and their point for the day is just to start baking all the breakfast breads, all the baked goods, all the cookies, all the muffins, all the cupcakes. Mm-hmm. All of that's baked every day fresh.
Right.
So then, you know, the next wave of people kind of come in at like 6 o'clock and they're helping putting all the finishing touches on things, getting it all upstairs, mm-hmm. and then working on that day's orders.
Okay, and when you say that day's orders, people order cakes, people order mm-hmm. all sorts of things.
All kinds of things. Like today we had, we make a thing called a cakesicle. It's like a cake pop, but it's in the shape of a popsicle. And we
go to BT, what is your...
It's Buttercream Bake Shop, but the word buttercream has all the vowels removed.
Right, all the vowels removed. BTTR, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Buttercream Bake Shop
on
Instagram.
Check up her Instagram account. You absolutely have to look at it.
But so today we had to make 400 of them with like patriotic colors on them for a voting thing tomorrow.
Sure.
So, you know, we just have like all... And we also had an order for about 100 little cookies that were like wiener dogs that were really, really funny.
Okay.
So, you know, we have like all kinds of random stuff. Everything, we really try to tailor it as much as we can to people's events.
Well, it's just amazing that you have the... ability to do that given the size of the bakery. I mean, you have a massive you have a good size kitchen.
We have a nice size kitchen. It definitely fills up on busy wedding weekends, but
sure.
You know, we are starting to now run into this problem where we're having to close off custom orders because we just can't take everything. We want to make sure that we can give the attention we need to the orders we have. So that's a bit of an issue, but I mean, it's everybody keeps saying it's a good problem to have, but it is a problem because we hate saying no. We hate turning people away.
Well, because you don't
want to
piss people off.
We don't. We want to be part of their special day. You know, we don't want to say no, but at the same time, we have to honor the quality that we promise to people. So we only have so much space and so many hands. And at a certain point, you just have to say, sorry.
You can't say yes to everything. I mean, you do know that.
We do.
Well, on that note, I think, you know, given the arc of your career, you know, how do you, as a small woman-run business, have work-life balance? And I hate using that terminology. It's so millennial. But I do feel that, especially in the restaurant industry, the food industry in general, you know, chefs, people in the back of the house, people in the front of the house, everybody works themselves to death.
It's true. Even the worst restaurant you've ever been to has somebody that's killing themselves to keep it running.
Right.
Like, that's what I always try to remember when I go to any food service industry, like any business. I remember...
With razor-thin margins, yes, I'd like to add. Like,
they're losing money,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
The people that work the hardest are the people that are losing the most money because they're just trying to keep it afloat. It's the worst. It's just not a great... You know, it's a hard industry. And I think my husband and I... We're both really bad at trying to understand work-life balance at all until I opened this business and he opened his own restaurant. We had just never respected it or appreciated it or really understood why anybody cared about it. And then, you know, as we get older and get more tired, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
We were working all the time.
Well, not only that, I know this sounds like a given, but you're literally on your feet all day.
All day,
like, it's not like you can sit down and, you know, bake.
Totally. I feel like chefs, like, live in, like, dog years. Right. You know what I mean? It's like every year that you exist as a chef is like three regular human years.
Right.
But, you know, so when we opened these restaurants, we said, you know what? I haven't even been on a vacation in, like, 5 years. We have to find a way to run businesses that can allow us to take at least one day off and go on a vacation and, you know, do the things that we need to do to kind of regroup and, revive ourselves.
Sure.
I'm really proud to say that at the bakery, everyone gets 2 days off a week, including myself. I go on vacation every year. And, like, I've kind of learned to look at it and say, you know, success isn't only about having a lot. It's not only about having multiple locations and multiple venues and multiple people that you, you know, wholesale accounts that you sell to. It's about having a place that you're really proud of, that does well, that takes care of you and your employees, and that you, you know, is successful on its own. And that's, I've really learned that that's enough and I can be really happy with that. Like, every time I'm tempted, you know, with the carrot of a new property that's so, so amazing, you've got to check it out. I'm like, you know what? I honestly don't even want to see it because I don't want to be tempted. Everything's so great right now. I just want to keep building this and keep making it better because every business can always be better. We're still constantly trying to, like, reinvent things, find new things to offer people, you know. When you're just opening more and more and more properties, you're spread so thin, you can't focus on kind of continuing to grow the business.
Well, I think you make a very valid point. And I am sure, given the real estate community in this city and the desire for, you know, well-profiting properties, I'm sure you're getting hit up by everybody.
Well, and also there's so many new residential buildings. They want things that kind of draw people to living in them.
Sure, they want amenities.
Yeah, so having a great bakery and a nice, you know, pharmacy type place and a good restaurant in the basement and the ground floor is a huge selling point.
Right.
But, you know, there's no such thing as an easy spot. There's no such thing as a small one that's not going to take any time. Like, every single one of them takes your entire life. It is you. It becomes you.
Of course.
I mean, I was talking with a friend the other day, and a friend of mine who just opened a restaurant overworked herself and had to go to the hospital for like 3 days. And I was telling someone about this, and they said it was a non-work person, not a non-restaurant person. And they said, you know what's crazy? For being so worried about sustainable food, you guys are so unsustainable in the way you run your lives. Like, you're not even worrying about yourself as much as you're worrying about the food that you put on the plates. And I was like, wow. That was a really powerful thing for someone to say to me because I was like, that is so
right.
So true. We're so focused on, like, sustainable food and, like, helping farmers and, you know, but then we're, like, running ourselves into the ground
and
cooking ourselves to the point of having to go to the hospital. You know, not everybody, but, you know, that is a thing.
Well, listen, as a whole, and I sort of want to end on this because, believe it or not, the time's over. Hour goes fast, especially with friends. But, you know, the D.C. food community, the food and wine community, is ever generous.
Oh, my
when
God.
It comes to not just supporting one another, obviously, as we discussed, but every charity, every event that's going on out there. You guys get hit up all the time.
Yes.
And I know you're really involved with Share Our Strength.
Mm-hmm.
So can we talk a little bit about your involvement? Because actually next week I have Debbie Shore coming on the show.
Oh God, Debbie's amazing.
She's amazing.
They're so great. Well, I work with Share Our Strength. I actually work with a few different charities regularly. Mm-hmm. Share Our Strength, the Human Rights Campaign. There's a local charity that works with children that have come out of like really horrible abusive home situations.
Wait, what's
called
its name?
Safe Shores.
Safe Shores, right? They
Safe
do amazing
Shores
stuff.
Is like my everything.
Sure.
Everybody, please look it up. Do what you can to support them. There's a group like this in every state. So if you're not in DC, find the one in your local area. What they do is literally, and I'm not even a religious person, it is literally God's work.
Sure.
It is like so selfless and so important. But, you know, I work with them. I work with Safe Shore, with Share Our Strength, who's mm-hmm. great. I mean, I was really lucky this year. I got to go out to California and see some really amazing food at school, like school breakfast programs that they're implementing where the kids actually eat in class, and all of these amazing statistics that they had for how much better the kids were doing knowing that they'd eaten a meal.
Sure.
Rather than going all morning hungry.
Right.
You know, D.C. is amazing. I said I would never get involved in politics when I moved here, and I think it's impossible not to, in, at least in a little bit of a way. But because of all of the politics here, there are a lot of amazing charities, and so many of the chefs are involved in them. And it's hard because you want to say yes to everyone, and you want to be a part of all of them. But a lot of us have now chosen to really dig deep for the ones that matter to us the most. And for us, it tends to be kids.
Well, and I completely get that. And I think I can say this. Because I can't tell you how many times people call me and say, well, you have all these restaurant contacts. You know, this is a charity. And I'm like, yeah, and it is. And it's a good one.
Totally.
But so are the 18,000 other ones. So there's a lot of important charities out there. Not everybody. And when the chefs work with these charities, I think I want to just remind people, 9 times out of 10, they're leaving their kitchens. Mm-hmm. They're not getting paid for product. It's just donated.
Total donation, yeah.
Which means that's coming out of their bottom line and staffing. So there's so many things that go into it. It is a generous donation from whatever mm-hmm. restaurant or bakery you're working with. And I just think people need to remember that because they just think, oh, can't you just give me a gift
and
card for $100?
Also, the people sending it, please remember, because we have to say no. We get literally 3 to 4 requests a week.
Oh, I bet.
Every single week. And, you know, when we first opened, I was saying yes to almost everything. And then eventually I had to say,
you're like giving away the farm.
I was. I said, listen, and I also felt like we were doing a small amount for a lot of people rather than going all in on a few things and doing a much bigger amount for them that felt, you know, like the whole staff could really get involved and
right.
felt more substantial and just really felt good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everybody on the staff is really into the charities that we work with. And I love that about it.
Well, I think it's important. And I think you should pick your causes. And I know it's really hard for you to say no because you really like to make people happy. But if you haven't had the opportunity to check out what Tiffany McIsaac is doing, please go to her Instagram account.
Mm-hmm.
Say it again.
Buttercream Bake Shop, but buttercream has no vowels. So
right, she made it really difficult. But she has like how many thousand of followers do you have?
It's like 35 and change.
Yeah, she's got a following. So check her out because her Insta stories and her photos are fabulous and really show off the work that she and her team are doing. But of course, if you're in D.C., you absolutely must go to Buttercream Bake Shop.
Yes, please come by.
Give the address.
1250 9th Street Northwest.
And the website?
And the website is buttercreamdc.com.
Excellent.
And when you come, you can also come. There's a bunch of great restaurants in the neighborhood, so you can come and make a
you
day
of it. You don't need to sell them. You don't need
to
sell them.
Oh, no, but I do because they're all my friends.
I know. Well, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thanks for having me.
It was it's always a treat to spend time with you, and I'm so thrilled for all your success, paying off your supporters, and it's amazing. So congratulations.
Thank you.
It's cheers to you, my darling. I want to thank all of you for joining us today on Industry Night. We were talking with Tiffany McIsaac, who is the pastry chef and owner of Buttercream Bakery, and we're here in the Fabulous Line Hotel talking about all things delicious. Thanks for joining us today. Please join us on Sunday, November 11th at Blue Jacket Brewery for our 10-year anniversary of Foodie and the Beast. It is a 2-hour show, and all of your favorite notables will be there. And join us next week. We'll have Debbie Shore from Share Our Strength in studio. Everybody, please have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.